You're listening to the Law of Attraction Radio Network.
Welcome to Quantum Leap Book Club. During the next hour, beloved mind scientist Parisha and her guests from around the world will read and discuss various best-selling books with well-known authors. Every show will apply retention techniques designed to help you to absorb powerful knowledge to effectively change your life. Join us every week for a thought-provoking hour and re-listen as often as you can. You will be delighted by what you learn, and you will be excited by the results. Are you ready to take the quantum leap? Here's Parisha.
Welcome to Quantum Leap Book Club. This is your host, Parisha, and I am back from many, many miles of traveling this week to join you. And my co-hosts are with me. Marianne Love is actually doing some kind of a program this weekend, so we're not going to be able to have her on with us, but we have Trina in Denver, Colorado. Trina, can you tell us a little bit about what you do and what your interests are?
Yeah, hi, this is Trina. And as Parisha said, I do live in Denver, Colorado. I have been a lifelong entrepreneur and business leader, really interested especially in the growth of small businesses. I'm also what I consider myself an activist, but also a sacred activist.
I like that word.
Yeah, and I've worked on campaigns to create a new county in Colorado. I chaired a campaign for GMO labeling initiative here. So my interests are kind of making things happen on the ground as well, both in business and in community.
Okay, very, very good. And we also have Rosemary Heyer, and she's in Frankfurt, Germany, joining us as one of our co-hosts. Rosemary, can you give us a little bit on your background and interest?
Yes, I'm happy to do that. I'm living in Frankfurt, Germany, and I have been running a company called English for Kids since about 10 years, and I'm running courses all over the area here for children in English. And also, I have been leading groups to visit indigenous people in the world. That is one of my passions I'm interested in other cultures. I also work in the refugee movement, help movement here on a local political level, but also as a volunteer. And I'm excited to be on the call. And it's always excited to be with Parisha.
Right. Thank you. And Geraldine Dalvival, who is in Sydney, Australia, in the Down Under. In fact, here in North America, we're actually having our winter, and guess what? They're beginning their summer. How are you doing down there, Geraldine?
Really well. Summer started early and plenty of heat. The sun is powerful
right
at this time.
Tell us a little bit about what you do.
The key part would be bringing nature back into urban areas. So this includes actual physical work on ground. So we have a company called Dragonfly that actually plants trees, manages weed species, keeps nature being cared for. And we have another one that really works to provide education and engagement for the whole sector, from students right through to people who are doing development and government agencies, in how to rekindle that connection for nature and bringing it into the urban areas. I guess like Trina mentioned too, a very big interest in business and business organization, particularly in alignment with the universal principles. And more today, we're seeing an acknowledgement that when we work with nature in any sphere, particularly business, we get much better outcomes.
Wonderful. You're right on with that. Okay, and we have Dr. Joyce Mullenhauer, who is a naturopathic doctor, as well as an RN. Joyce, can you give us a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Yes. What my main employment at the moment is as a hospice nurse. And what I've really enjoyed particularly about Stitchin's work is that nursing and the medical field is in a great throw of change, thank goodness. If there's a very strong movement away from what has not worked, just during surgeries, during chemicals as medications. So it is just an absolute delight to me to have anything that broadens the whole concept that we have had as limited thinkers. So that's where my strong interest is.
All right. Very, very good. Thank you all for that. Okay. So this week I want to take some time to actually deal with when we're in Chapter 11 and we're in the book called The Chronicles of the Anunnaki Chronicles, and that's by Janet Stichett. Okay, I want to deal with that because most, I would say, a good maybe 60 of my 78 seasons on this earth, I have worked with the tablets, which are basically what Stichett and the other particular archaeologists and scientists have been looking at that's come out of the Middle East and some places in Europe. Okay, there is a tremendous wealth of those tablets and those particular, what we have codices that's on different kinds of cactus paper. We have it actually inside a lot of the particular stones that come out of Mexico. We have it written within the stone caves and particular rocky areas in the Southwest. So we have a tremendous amount of that information here. And my whole interest, and it's just been over the last maybe year and a half, we could push it maybe 2 years, that I heard about Stichett's stuff, and it was brought to me by a scientist that actually has very much been involved a great deal of his life in following up with Stichett's particular profile of what he has learned through studying the different tablets. And it come up through a conversation. Now, not to say that years and years and years I've heard about Zachariah Stichett, just never picked up on a book or any part, you know, of the particular Anunnaki studies. Now, your particular word for the Anunnaki is different than my peoples and most of the indigenous peoples anywhere on the earth. Okay, the Anunnaki is a term basically that I feel is more common to the scientific end of this than it is for the ancient particular value of the artifacts and tablets. In all these years, symbols, the actual symbology that comes in the readings has been the most powerful for me. Learning how to actually look at a piece of art, a drawing, and actually being able to realize inside each line of that drawing, there is actually a symbol and a particular ancient language that came way before we began to try and speak and understand each other. And when you look at that and how much that exists in what we're looking at now, we have to realize that in nature, like if you've ever looked into the Fibonacci mathematics and the particular geometry of that, you understand how powerful that comes. And it comes out of actually finding universal sounds that create certain images, and that's what we're talking about as symbols. So a lot of what happens with these tablets and what I have discovered in the many years of my working with it is that they become holographic to us. After you've been with them for quite a while, as I have, and you've read them, it doesn't matter what they put in front of you, and most of my life has been working with people that'll say, okay, we don't understand this one, or this one's different from what's your name, so we would like you to look at it. It speaks for itself, as everything else does, because remember, it is a record, it is a history, it is a communication, and in itself, it's timeless. It doesn't relate to the now, like it's an ancient, measured period of whenever before, okay? It isn't, it's present. And in whoever and however it become a communication or written document that's part of our history, it actually still stays very much as a functional part of their lives because it didn't have an alphabet that had several letters in it to make a word. It actually had to have a symbol of what was going on, an action. It was a person. It was a thing. And in that thing gives off of itself an impression and a field of energy. So that what happens after you've read tablets and definitely in reading this book and looking into what Zachariah has done, I know for a fact that in many instances when other people's interpretations were totally opposite of how he was going to move forward with it, I knew it was because he was in touch with the holographic form of that. Now, how does that mean that the earlier interpreters were inefficient? No, it doesn't. It actually says that they were interpreting it from whatever we will call their particular perspective in their time period, okay? So, like how we've discussed this already on the show many times, look at the world we live in. People are going to the moon. We got kind of space activity out there. We're having visitations. We're now into the quantum field of studies. We know that there are no boundaries to intelligence. Okay, so we can actually look at these tablets from a much larger and expanded awareness. So there's so much more in it. It's like you can take a very little small circle of very intricate design, and in it is a universe of information. I mean, just the depth of it is just unmeasurable, okay? So we begin to look at that. And what we're doing now is realizing that, okay, first and uppermost, the northern part of North America was an ice cap, okay? So you're looking at thousands upon thousands of years. In fact, according to the indigenous people of North and South America, we're looking at millions of years. Forget the thousands, okay? And so because of the ice cap, this particular northern part of our planet wasn't immediately involved in a lot of the traffic that the Anunnaki continued to have, even in these later periods of time. So it gets very exciting to me, and when I begin to look at this, and like the co-hosts and us discuss all of this, you're looking at the fact that the discoveries that are happening in Mexico, there is a wealth of information. Mexico was a major activity point for them. North America, as well as South America, has a tremendous amount of gold in its soil. So, of course, there's no way the Anunnaki overlooked that. So when we come to this chapter where Stitchin's actually showing and running the fact that we need to look at the fact that there's evidence in the Americas, of course there is. And as we have Inky and the particular brothers exploring more supply of gold coming through Africa and into the Americas, and that there is really very few places on this planet that they have not touched, either directly by the first family, which I feel is Enlil, Inky, and that particular branch of brothers and sisters, okay? But the later parts, the later bloodlines, how they've integrated, this whole planet has their history. The planet herself is part of the history. Like in our tablets, it actually deals with where Sitchin actually talks about us, the consciousness that's us, not the body that's us, but the consciousness that's us actually was in the planets. We were planets, you know, and that's been kind of hard to talk about in a lot of the different sharing and teaching I do with people of interest, because, you know, they're still trying to deal with the fact they're not a body. Now you're telling them they were a planet, okay? So it gets kind of hairy, on the, to say the least, okay? So basically, actually exploring ourselves as planets is what's actually starting to break through into the quantum field. You have to go through the quantum field to actually begin to entertain anything like that. And Stitchin actually has a book on it, on the planets and how the planets, the War of the Planets, where he talks about each of them being a personality and one of the historic members of the Anunnaki families. So when we begin to look at that, then we have to realize that Earth herself is the remains of Tiamat, and that they're still gouging and digging gold out of her. So when you come to the indigenous perspective of spirituality, the focus is the mother. And it's purely because of that. The very nature of mixture of what the Anunnaki used, and Stitchin picks up on that a little bit in this chapter, where he goes back over the viewing of how the, you know, they came to hear from Nibiru, Inky came, and then come in, and then how it all begins, okay? And if you've been reading that, I'm sure you're aware of what I'm talking about. If not, to be clear with that, there were the first particular people landing here, and as they begin to move and create and build what we call the human body, which is us, okay, they had to find another species here on this planet that was actually natural to the planet. And that was the matter of they needed something, some peoples or a body that was stronger than the ones that they were using of themselves to dig their gold. So there obviously was something of a being, we're not going to call it human, a being that was here and was actually natural to Tiamat and her particular works. In the Native American perspective, and if any of you are actually interested in that, you might want to get a book that's called Copper Woman Speaks. And it actually deals with how the actual bringing about of human beings, and especially the species of us. So it has its own line of communication, but one of very much interest if you want to look at that. But in all of our medicine ways and in all of the tablets that we have, all of this is very clear and very much in line with what Stitchin has put here, okay, and the various programs. When you get to the latter part of the chapter, it talks about all the particular evidence of the different things that they've discovered throughout Africa, South America, as well as the North America. And you're seeing how they're relating that it has a somatic particular art, it has this, it has that. So it keeps connecting us back to the Middle East, when actually everything shows at this point where they started the origins, they being the Anunnaki, was actually in Iraq and the Middle East. Okay, and I find that so understandable then that that is always such a melting pot of war, disagreements, and separation. And the healing of that is actually working itself throughout the nature of all of us and our consciousness. So when I've asked the co-hosts, you know, when we come in each week, why are you interested in this particular subject of the Anunnaki? How does that do anything, if at all, anything for your day? How does this make what you're working with, or maybe your own personal transformation? How are you using this to understand and actually know how it fits right now? Because what we actually do on our radio show here, as well as all the other shows here, okay, is that we look for something to help you become better at being whatever you want in your goals and dreams, okay? So then how does this kind of in-depth stuff fit into that? And again, a lot of you that send information and you're not Christian and you find this pretty much hard to get through because Zachariah Stitchin continues to bring it back to Christianity, I'd like you to just kind of put that particular view aside and put a whole other suggestion to just think about. Okay, I don't see Zachariah so much hammering Christianity with this as much as he's actually exploring what we would consider the biblical scriptures. Okay, and those biblical scriptures aren't just ones, especially that I'm watching how he handles. I find in all other, I studied theology for about 5-6 years and went all over the world investigating all kinds of religions. Okay, and it exists in all of them. So there's like some commonality, some threads that actually binds us together if that's what we wanted to focus on and was looking for common ground instead of separation. What I want to say is the reason I'm finding it so exciting with us reading the book, and I so appreciate all of you who's been following us. This is not easy material to talk about on a talk show. Okay, it really isn't. The co-host, I want to commend you for even putting in whatever you have, because unless our readers are actually reading these chapters with us, they probably are saying, where are they at? What are they talking about? Whatever else, right? But it's like, you really do have to understand, it is weaving itself into where we're at now. The consciousness shift that's happening, you know, like working within the last month or so with the political positioning our governments are taking on what they're labeling the millenniums, okay? And hearing that and realizing that what I'm looking at in all of the influence of the Anunnaki, and actually looking at ourselves as our bodies are an engineered perfection. You're not this body. You are what works through this body. And for us to begin to explore that as beings, and actually moving past all of the addictions we have to just being solid matter and actually doing everything we can to work in the brain and in the head and in consciousness to lighten that up, okay? And then you throw this in and you actually realize this perfect, beautiful piece of flesh and blood that we work through is actually an engineered robotic kind of thing, okay? And so when you come to that, you begin to look at, why would you want to know anything about the Anunnaki? It's because we're going to live it again and again and again and again until finally we have evolved to a place to where we have control of that consciousness, not someone else. So in discussing how with the particular Anunnaki families, the first ones to come, I'm going to call them the original ones, actually began to create the human body, and took one of Tiamat's natural children, something that actually come from the very planet and the soil itself. And they mix their DNA in with this particular being's DNA, and voila, what do you have? You have human beings, very strong, very intelligent human beings. And we have been brainwashed into some of the darkest information you could ever possibly have to weed through. You've been put into places with religions terrified to ask a question. You have actually been limited to what you particularly could say and have and do, thinking everything else in the world's in charge of it but you. And that's changing now. So it's very appropriate right now that we are introducing and talking about the Anunnaki influence in what we're doing. Yes, will Nibiru show itself again? Of course, it's a cyclic influence. Of course it will. Will it crash into our planet? No, it has its own path, okay? It already did one of those numbers with Tiamat. Now it's not going to bother Ela. That's inside one of the stronger gravitational fields. Okay, very recently talking to scientists that are dealing with what actually the scale of consciousness that they're picking up through their satellite measurements in their computers, showing how different incidents that are happening on our planet and different things that are going on. They're studying the auric field of all of this, the particular energies around it, and realizing how it's developing and how it's moving ahead and how we're actually becoming people that have control of things, that can make different things happen. We don't have to settle for that. We can actually have it another way if we want. And they're seeing this happening. So consciousness is being measured right now. And the sun, we have, like I have people who actually report here in a very close proximity of people I work with that actually watch the particular news and everything on the sun and the solar flares and everything. But I have in-depth scientists that are looking at it at a much higher level. And so the exciting of the sun's activities is for a very long time, our sun was subdued. And in the Anunnaki teachings and stuff you're reading with Stitchin, they actually, the particular original family, blanketed the energy that the sun could actually have an influence into the solar system. That energy is being given back to us now. So the solar energy is intensifying, but it's not something we need to worry about and think we're going to be burned to a crisp. It's actually having effects right now. There's all kinds of studies that shows that the sun, like when Deb and Steve and a few people give me reports, actually in the report it'll say this is going to have effects on people with high blood pressure, it's going to have some kind of psychological effect and everything. So they are knowing that the sun is affecting that. But what they're not telling you in those predictions is the effects it's having on stimulating very, very dormant areas of our brain. So now we have young people that have been more affected by that are being labeled millennials and thinking that they're strange because they're not necessarily on the money track. They feel more as a community than they do a business. They want different. Their values are different. They want to be together. They don't need to individually separate themselves. So they're bringing in some ideas and thoughts, and it's kind of throwing off all the politicians because it's like they have a particular patent in a box we all fit in, right? Well, the millennials don't fit in there. Okay, so when we come back to that, that's not just affecting the millennials who are an age group anywhere from 18 to 35. It's every one of us. And those solar activities have totally integrated. And one of the last conference I was in, one of the scientists that measures that says that the energy around the Earth has accelerated to a very high level. And that's having effect on how people are thinking and how the brain is actually working. So when we say we're studying the Anunnaki and all of this particular stuff, we're not just trying to get you to start looking at some things that maybe be totally off your list of I wants, okay? But we hope that you're using it to see how it's still all here and how we're still discovering and bringing all this out. And here in North America, we don't have to go to the Middle East to explore this. We don't have to go to anywhere else in the world. You have the Pueblo people, and definitely any of the time you can get to spend in Mexico, we have definitely a lot of energy now that has come down out of Honduras. when we had all of that effects at the border and we were saying it's all about people coming here looking to have, you know, get citizenship in the United States. You had 8,000 to 10,000 people migrating toward the border. It was because a very powerful being that they associated with and took care of and lived in, because they're not part of the insanity of the outer world, actually was brought down through the border and is in North America at this point. And with her, they began to follow, to find, and to come with her. Some of them not even knowing and understanding what was drawing them forward. But that's what happened at the border. And that these entities are still with us. These entities help and have taught many how to read these tablets. It isn't something we need to be afraid of. It's something we need to welcome. The more you understand what's going on and how much these particular weekly studies, and God bless the co-hosts that are doing everything they can to try and help this make some sense to you. We are literally trying to help you understand. There is a great awakening happening. There are ruins that are being brought out daily. We just had a trip into Egypt where there was just actually an assignment and a mission was given us to where we were to go there and actually do some work with Thoth. And then when we look at this and we see in this chapter, it starts explaining who Thoth is. Okay, so everything is fitting in. And we thank you for following us each week and listening to our desperate attempts to try and make this fun and trying to keep it light and to keep it interesting. So we hope that you'll bear with us with that and continue with that. But pay very close attention to chapter 11. And know that you, in whatever state you're in North America, okay, as we the humans begin to migrate north, we all came out through Mexico and South America, the more southern hemispheres, and we begin to move north. So I have a lot of complications occasionally with Native people who will say they have always been here. No, they have not always been here. You have some that came down through the Bering Strait, and they're very larger and taller Native people and look very much like Mongolians because they are of that DNA. And then you have the Pueblo people who come up from the south and through Mexico and the Red Cities. And Palenque being very, very much a very large part of our North American history, okay? And so all of this is coming together in what we're trying to share and help you get out of this book. And since we're more than about halfway through it, I wanted to make sure that you realize we have a reason to feel this is important enough to help you get information and understand it better. And we feel that even with our attempts of just picking particular areas of the book to discuss with you will help you begin to do that. You have here in the Southwest a very strong concentration of information that the Pueblo peoples have. The Taos people have a great deal of it, as well as the Pueblo people of Arizona. And those would be the Hopi, the Laguna, and a number of other people who have tablets that are yet to be discovered and actually talked and spoken of. And anything that you spend in the time and with the canyons and those informations, remember, you are actually involved in holographic history, being very, very present and being released. Some of it will be actually controversial, so we're trying to make sure that there are certain missions that are given out, as I discussed our trip to Egypt was, to where we can go and be a collective consciousness that actually changes the very environment of the field. And there are many, many groups and people who are working with that. So why the Anunnaki? Why not? That helps us understand exactly where we begin and obviously where we're going to end up. So with our weekly conversations and our discussions, again, I want to thank my co-host for actually keeping everything moving while I did a tremendous amount of traveling and investigating myself, okay? So at this point, I'd like to ask you, co-host, how, if anything, would you be able to add to this? What part of this chapter have you gotten very much interested in and want to discuss? Can we start with you, Rosemary?
Yes, I would love to start and share some of the things, and I just wanted to say that especially this chapter and the whole book, it is opening so much a big space of a huge history of we have not been made aware of in our traditional education. And even this chapter, I think, is only the tip of the iceberg because you cannot cover everything. I mean, I was very excited about the Egyptian pyramid when we were there and to see that this was definitely not built by hand, how they teach us in the school. But when you look at this chapter and you look at even at those few pictures he has in there, it is amazing what has happened there in that area, in Mexico, in Guatemala, in Peru. I mean, all these stones cut exactly the same way how in the pyramids where there's nothing fits in between. It was not a primitive people, how they try to tell us. It was really a high civilization and it was guided by some very high beings called the Anunnaki. And there's a lot of evidence. And one of the evidence I got more and more interested in, I wanted to actually learn more about them, is the Olmecs. I mean, they were actually described as the mother culture because it's probably the first culture they discovered, the oldest one from 4,000 to 1,500 BC. And Zakaria is sharing that they are known for these colossal hats, and their faces look like African faces. Where did they come from, and what did they do? Well, they were mining. What did they mine? Gold. Well, that sounds very familiar with what we have learned about the Sumerians. And they also had some very interesting stone culturing. Actually, they were mostly communicating by stone sculptures. And one of them was the so-called Izapa steles, or their large obelisks and sculptures. They had 60 of them, very, very finely sculptured, which also, I think, was not done only by a hammer and a chisel, but it was probably done by energetic work. They were actually living at the Pacific coast near the border of Mexico and Guatemala. The Olmecs were followed by the Mayan people, by the Maya people, which is very interesting. So this Izapa stele had a picture in there which actually referred to the Sumerians and to the Anunnaki. There's a picture in there. Yep. With an old man with a beard who's white, stretched out his arm, was teaching, and he, in front of him, between him and the other person, was an umbilical cutter, something which the goddess of Ninti had used to fashion the human being. Also, he was white because the indigenous people in that area are not having any beard, and he was teaching. So that was inside of that sculpture from the Olmecs. There was inside of it a tree of life which had 12 roots. Well, the number of 12 is coming up all the time everywhere in this chapter, and we know that there were 12 Sumerian gods, 12 Anunnakis, who were guiding the civilization in Mesopotamia. So there's a lot of things in there, and I just want to stop now. But the Olmecs people are very interested in society, and they have done a lot influence into all the other cultures which followed, like the Mayan people, which is really exciting.
Very good. That was great. Thank you. And when we begin the chapter, in the gray box-in part of the wording where Janet actually adds her own particular words and stuff, you have that, as far as Sitchin is concerned, he feels that the history in the Americas, or the arrival of the Anunnaki influence here, is he feels that that is pretty much in Titicaca. Well, it's not. It's not. It actually started in what many of us have understood as Lemuria, and coming up from the very, very deep south. So it did work its way to Lake Titicaca, but definitely not the starting place of it. You had definitely signs of it even in Australia, and we have a couple of our co-hosts that are from Australia. You definitely have the black people there that are called Aboriginals, okay, that still have markings. And as I was there and asked to come there and actually look at some of their ruins and stuff, this is the same ruins I can go to the Middle East, or I could go to Siberia and find. So are we connected with this? Yes. And the central point of it is that wherever there was gold, that attracted them. And of course, as Rosemary, you just shared, Africa would have to be one of those places. So then that influence. And there's actually parts, I don't know, I know in our tablets, we actually speak of the black giants. So there's actually direct Anunnaki DNA, because they would be the giants The average size of somebody that's an Anunnaki starts anywhere from 10 to 15 to 18 feet high. Okay, so definitely there is a time of giants, and that would be the Anunnakis. Okay, so when we know that that's in part of our tablets, that we actually have tablets that cover the arrival as well as the final dispersing of black giants. Okay, so that, just to give you a head, that starts even farther down in the southern hemisphere, and down and around where we would look for Atlantis is definitely some influence around the reefs of what we still know as Australia. Okay, at this point, can we have, Geraldine, would you like to join us now and add some information from some of the particular parts of 11?
Absolutely, and a key part is the, as we're just talking about, the migrations. And as I was reading, I found I kept needing to stop and look things up, because it would say people from the, you know, Indo-Europeans would come across and arrive in the area that we now call Ecuador. And in my mind, the word Europe took me to the other side of the planet. And I was like, why would they come across the Pacific? So then in Googling and clearing that word Indo-European, I learnt that it was part of what we would now call Eastern Ukraine and Southern Russia. And they're nomadic peoples that moved in several waves, particularly around the third millennium, which is, say, 3000 to 2000 BC, the same time as that, what we would call the early Middle Age or Bronze Age, which is when the, what's called the ancient Near East, or the empires of Sumeria and the others, were really coming into being. So we have these particular time points through time, and we have these migrations of people, and this is factual. So what we're looking at, again, in the whole chapter, in the whole book that Stichman's put together, is interesting history based on facts. And then when it's, we can look on top of it, and we have things, you know, as you've been sharing, with the giants, with the gold, with the pictures. So as I've been reading the chapter and looking up, it's these migrations that are very interesting to me. And what it brings up is, say, when I did my DNA test, it says, I'm partly from here and I'm partly from there, you know, these parts of the world. You know, basically for me, it's sort of Celtic and Nordic, very far from my current, you know, choice of my spirit in this life being born on Australia. And also drawing upon the information by Professor Fred Alan Wolfe, who says it's only 31 generations back that we're all connected. So having these different sciences, because he's a physicist, and then the work of Nassim Haramein, who shows us some of the different technologies that could be put in place, like one they call cold fusion, that would have made stones soft. And he then says, you know, in Egypt, in the South Americas, in the different places we see these megalithic structures, they almost seem that the rocks are melted onto each other. And he then gives a scientific perspective of how, by understanding gravity and more of the quantum, it gives us a different set of realities of how these structures could have been put together. So in terms of this chapter, I'm looking at the sharing of gods, common roots that we have, and explanations that show, as you mentioned, in this magnificent engineered body, there is so much more to not only our knowledge of material world, but to the spirit connection. And as I know others will cover, just things like that, sacred geometry and alignment with the planets. Just even just talking about it, there's a feeling that's created where you go, wow, you know, thank goodness for the millennials and all the others coming through, because it's a good future.
It's a very good future. And looking at the very points that you're making with that, what I want to bring back to mind, because you work in nature. All of nature, everything is energy, and energy communicates. And all we have to do, and it's what we're in the process of learning, is to be open to accept that possibility. We don't have to say we believe until we do believe. And how do you begin to believe? You have the experience. What I want to share with that is, okay, everything that we're looking at in the tablets has symbology in it. Symbols actually create a field. A geometric field around it. Okay, so the energy at all these tablets that we have, all of these ancient sites, our world is our Earth herself is a working, communicating, and evolving herself into us, okay? And so basically with everything else that we're needing to pay attention to is like when we're Rosemary's covered and so has Geraldine, is that we're looking at the fact that we are in the midst of this. So the satellites are measuring now how there are places on the earth that are overgrown and they're very deep in the earth and they're active. There's actually surface activity and they're hundreds if not thousands of feet under soil or they're overgrown with a forest or that's how we're actually starting to find some of the ancient sites. That's because they're still alive, they're still energy, they're still communicating. So that these tablets are actually holographic fields that are actually interacting. You, when you're with it and what we're learning to be and what the Anunnaki seed or the Anunnaki DNA has given us is also a very strong psychic perspective as well as what we've gotten from the natural particular beings that came out of Tiamat. So we ourselves are a very advanced species. And that we are moving very fast now that we have available information. And when we look at any of these ruins, I would encourage any of you who are drawn to a particular place or going to a particular area, go there, even if you're saying, but there's actually no ruins or anything there. You don't know that. You have no idea what's under the soil or what's in the soil. And so go there, because those things begin to work and begin to pull and have energy effects with you. So as we're talking about a lot of these lost cities in particular places where it says these discoveries have been made, look at some of those sites and make sure that you spend time with it. Go in areas around you that are open fields, like getting out into nature, because the soil is full of history. The planet herself is a book of just layer upon layer of history. So get into the environment and let it begin to help you evolve. Okay, let's come back now and let's let Dr. Joyce, would you like to share some part of the book?
Yes, I would love to. What I found as I read this particular chapter, felt a little bit like Stitchin was taking us on a travelogue. And the more I read, the more I wanted to look up more information on each of these areas. I particularly became interested when they talked about the giants. If we were standing beside one of these giants, we just reached their knees. So I started to feel, well, if I had a being that just stood to my knees, I would get a better concept, perhaps, of how they did have greater strength. But beyond that, I think there is a tendency for us to try to relate to what we can do today and not expand our minds maybe to the point we could, that there's many things that they were able to do that we hopefully are going to learn and definitely have a chance at. The other piece that really caught my interest was that they could actually travel in a boat made of a reed. So there's an interesting research that was done in 1931 where they actually made a reed boat, and it ended up taking approximately 1.8 million reeds to make this boat. And 70 people worked at it and moved it to the shore. And then they were able, because they built it in a way, they were pretty much guessing, but they wanted to see if literally you could carry these major stones that ended up being like a monolith, or were monoliths, in their community that they built, how they could carry it across the water. And in this research project, they actually did move a 12-ton stone across the water in a boat made of reeds. So that was very interesting. And obviously, there is a whole lot of information out there for us to expand what we can believe is possible in what they accomplished.
Okay, I appreciate that. So getting back to the material in the book, okay, are there any of you who would like to share any particular ruins and digs that they are discussing here? I go over to page 262, and we come to where we have some monoliths here, okay? And I've actually, the obelisks that are here, I've actually seen them physically. I took a group many, many years ago, probably around 1991, that we went to Mexico to actually work and pioneer through some of the ruins and things that they had not yet quite found answers to in that. And so a lot of what the questions were when we begin to look at it is they have codexes that are on cactus, which are considered somewhere around 4,000 to 6,000 years old. Okay. And the monolith, that the obelisk that they're looking at actually is much older. And they do a tremendous amount of that in a particular stone, obsidian stone, that time would never touch. So when they went to carvings and that, it's just as fresh as the day they began to carve it. And it actually has a collection of all of the different faces and different particulars of that time. So it could be very much, in fact, I think in the book it says it's sort of like, or could be considered like a native totem pole. Exactly that, but only different in as much as usually totem poles are actually talking about particular people or a particular history or an event. This is actually like a collage of just different things of the time, and actually giving us a good history of it. And when we begin to look at that and study that, I was totally blown away with the fact that the anthropologist and the paleontologist that was with us are kind of traveling alongside of us in our adventure, actually begin to say, you know, it's just this. It's just totally dismissing it. And I loved it because one of the members in our party, it wasn't me. I'm definitely capable of it, but it wasn't me. That actually looked at the guy and said, I thought you guys were scientists. And they kind of blinked their eyes and said, well, yes, we are. And he said, I don't for the life of me understand then how a scientist could look at something so intricately placed, something so very perfect in its presentation, and the intelligence of picking a stone and a material that time could not erase. And you're standing there saying it's nothing other than a lollipop. And you should have seen the look on the scientist's face. I thought they were just going to pass out. But it was very true. And how they kept taking us through the different ruins and telling us how the Mayans did this and the Mayans did that. And, of course, we had a Mayan elder with us that challenged them and said, you're not Mayan. You've never truly studied Mayan history. So why would you be talking about Mayans at all? So I feel that when we're looking at Stitch and Stuff and what he's done here, what I respect of it the most is he does not dismiss that, and that each one of these particular drawings that he's sharing with us in the one over on 263, okay, definitely as a tablet reader and me reading that, I'm showing you here, this whole tablet is working toward totally levels of what I would consider, as you see the many faces and it's traveling up. This is an ancestral line that's present in the particular embodiment that's at the very front of the drawing, and all of the intricateness on the side is accomplishments and things that were done. So it's like you cannot dismiss it, along with every line. When you look at this picture on 263 there, especially around the entity itself, and it does very much look like it's a bull, and it would actually at this point is given the name of Taurus, okay, but every line and every little curvature that actually has a meaning. And it's because of the energy that particular drawing or that particular use of the pen or the carving would have. So, like I said, these are living stories. They are not just something standing there. And the codexes were alive. And while we were there, they took us into a chamber of codexes that they were not allowing the public to see. So it was the gift of a private viewing. And when I walked in and we began to stand there, I immediately felt something present with me, and I asked who it was. And when I did, all the lights went out in the museum. And at that point, it stayed very dark. And in the darkness, there was just a wealth of information that was given, to the point I felt very dizzy and almost vomited. Okay, and it was nothing other than the spinning that took place in that. And then when the lights came back on, one of the codexes that they had it very much protected in a cabinet had fallen over. And when the curator there said, oh my, so there was not an earthquake or something, was there, because this had happened. And I said, this is one they really need us to look at this point. And he was very cooperative in letting us do that. Of course, I couldn't touch it, but I didn't have to. And in reading that, it actually, like I said, we're looking at somewhere around 1990, 1991. And everything it said that was coming in the next 20 years has happened. And these are living stories. I have no doubt that that codex being read by someone else that's now 2019, okay, wouldn't say something different, because they reveal themselves as holograms that are growing with us. And that's the importance of what Stitchin is actually trying to show us here. Okay, in saying that, is there anyone that wants to share? What are we doing on time? Okay, before we get too far away, I'm going to ask you, Trina, to actually go to the end of the chapter and share the what information you can give us on the drawing from Machu Picchu.
Oh, yeah, great. This was really exciting for me because I was actually there about 15 years ago and did a tour around this whole area, Lake Titicaca, Cusco, Ollantaytambo, that whole Sacred Valley. This, for me, was like bringing back the things that I experienced, but with new eyes and new purpose. So it's pretty exciting. Right. One of the things that was very interesting about this whole area in kind of southeastern Peru, close to the border with Bolivia, this area, they're comparing to some in the Anunnakis, which he shared with us before, were these landing paths, the sites over in the Near East, in the Middle East, were always at what they charted out as like a 45-degree angle, where it would go toward the equator. In this landing route, everything was in this 45-degree angle. Well, as they started looking, some of the areas around Machu Picchu and that whole area, they started to begin to find, especially at Machu Picchu, that it was actually laid out with this angle of 45 degrees. There's actually a picture on page 107 that shows the lineup of these several windows inside of Machu Picchu. And when you put them in relation with this sacred stone that's there, they run in a 45-degree angle. There was a lecture by Maria Suchin Sultan, who was very intrigued after reading this book, which was La Ruta de Viracocha, which is the route of Viracocha. It talked about this 45-degree angle as well. And so she began to plot out from using Machu Picchu in this kind of diamond shape, you know, take a square and turn it on its side. It has the points. And that if you laid one with Machu Picchu and then you took the other one, another point was down near Tiahuacan in Bolivia. That ran in that same 45-degree angle. And so when you start looking at the sacred sites, if you start looking at what's down there in that area of Peru, and you start near Tiahuacan, near Lake Titicaca, and you move 45 degrees northwest, you come in line with the Isle of the Sun and the Moon, you come in line with Cusco, where we found Sacsayhuaman, huge monolithic stones all put together just like in the pyramids. Can't even slide anything in between them. And you move through Cusco direct in line to Machu Picchu. And then again, direct in line with Ollantaytambo, which is a very important site in Peru as far as these lines with solstices and equinoxes and just the way it's all laid out. Everything is laid out in geographical patterns there, most of them relating to that 45-degree angle, which was pretty much synonymous with what the Anunnaki were doing. And the building there, the stone structures in each one of these sites near Tiahuacan has the H stones that are precisely cut. They are absolutely incredible when you see them. It's like no one could have done these. No one could have lifted these. It had to have been something completely different. And now there's a wonderful program that's on TV called Ancient Aliens, where they have been going to these sites and bringing in the scientists. So I would recommend people, if they can get that particular program, to take a look at it, because they go in depth in some of the studies in the sciences.
Well, it's becoming such an acceptable conversation these days. It's like these are things that you had to talk about in private tea parties a few years back, okay? But right now, you can actually talk about it, and when we're saying aliens, we're talking about extraterrestrials that actually aren't natural to our planet, but natural to the universe. So still a part of us in one way or another. Everything in the universe is connected, not just our planet. So we're beginning to explore these various parts of us and the oneness that we are. It's kind of once we begin to realize that we're not the body, but the body is part of a larger complex part of what we are, okay, then we begin to see how all this links and how that this history serves. There are very powerful places every 100 feet of this planet, is a quote that Grandfather Rolling Thunder said to me many, many years ago as a young woman. He said, so every 100 feet you want to make sure that you take a breath and greet that which stays here. These are the earth keepers that keep telling us exactly where we were and where we will be again. And I honor that very much today, and everything that we're seeing here, and how much I actually give such gratitude, and sent a very a loving letter to Janet Stichett and the publishers and stuff of these books. There is so much for you to begin to understand and apply in your life. You don't have to go anywhere, just go outside the door, get out of the house. And when you're outside, make sure you become aware of all of the immense energy around you and the conversations and communications that are going on all the time. To know that you don't necessarily hear it the same as you hear me talking, but that you hear it, that you feel it, that you know it. This is exactly why we explore where our beginnings were and where we're going with it. And the evolving that's happening, that's called consciousness. We're all a part of it. You are important. You do make the difference, and you can make the change. So we're going to close for this week, and we thank you all for being with us. And we've had an excellent time. I know that I'm very happy to be back from my travels, and hopefully nothing calls me out on another mission before next Wednesday, and we'll see you then. Thank you, co-host from your various places on the earth, for being with us today. And may your week, and here in North America, we're celebrating Thanksgiving tomorrow. Remember to be appreciative to every breath you take. Meet somebody every day and make a difference in their life. Just smile. Have a good week. OCO.
Thank you for listening to Quantum Leap Book Club. For more information where you can contact us, go to loaradionetwork.com/quantum-leap. Have a great week.